Now, this is an extremely important thing, and then we're going to take a break. Stanley Getlow, a brilliant man who is an addiction specialist and was the great savior of the disease deal during the 70s, when he used to preach from the podiums in medical conferences that this was a disease and that everything would be revealed, and he postulated all the gene stuff and all the stuff that was in our molecular biology. And he teamed with a very brilliant young female psychologist at the time named Lynn Henneke. And they did a series of studies on some alcoholics in New York. This literature is very rarely ever quoted, and I'm intrigued by it because, boy, it sure should be. And when he came back, or she came back, he asked her what she'd found, and she found two things that were important. One was, she said, every alcoholic is a stimulus augmenter. That was irritable, restless, discontented. Like we said at a red light, it turns green, somebody honks at us. Normal people just move on off, and we get out and give them the finger. Or, you know, we drive for 3 miles, and then we hate ourselves for a month because we didn't get out and give them the finger. And I mean, I do that all the time, you know. And I've gotten to where I look in the mirror and see the age of the person honking at me, then I decide whether I'm going to give them the finger. But as I've gotten older, I mean, I'm really getting, my parameters are getting a lot more stringent. They better just be on a walker in their car before I ran. One of them was stimulus augmentation, which is irritable, restless, discontented. The other said that every alcoholic has a compromised relationship with a parent of the same sex. Said it will almost always present as a resentment or some aggression against the parent of the opposite sex, but the problem will be with the relationship with a parent of the same sex. Now, I was sitting on the front row. I'd been sober 1 year, and I'm sitting on the front row listening to that, and I thought, man, I'm having trouble with that. My daddy was one of the neatest men I've ever known. He was. We buried him in 92. And my God, what an incredible man. And I thought, I just didn't have a problem with my daddy. He's wonderful. If anything, it was one of my very most difficult problems with growing up, because I kept comparing myself to my daddy. And it was really, this man was exceptional. And I'm just grateful to be enough like him to be grateful for it. So I went up to Dr. Getlow and I said, I'm having trouble with this, sir. And we sat down and got to talk. He said, tell me your story. Well, I was born very poor. For the first 10 years of my life, my daddy had always had two jobs and sometimes three. And so he went to work before I got up in the morning and came home after I'd gone to sleep at night. I never saw my daddy except for 2 hours on Sunday morning when we went to church for almost the first 10 years of my life. My mother raised me, and most of my interpersonal skills are female. It's what made me a really good doctor. We had 18 doctors when I left practice, and only one female in those 18 doctors. And she was the best doctor of the group, not because she was smarter or wrote better scripts or made better diagnoses. She was able to listen, and she was able to nurture. And I know this is a general statement, but I can tell you that's what I've seen in most female physicians. And I was as close to her as any of the other males, because most of my skills of nurturing, which many psychiatrists have called codependency, and at one time they may have been right. They're not right today. It's called service. With good sponsorship, we can do service. And it may smell like codependency, but it's not. You know, and that will all be learned through this program. So my compromised relationship with my daddy was he just wasn't there. I learned all of my male skills out of dirty books and locker rooms. Mm-hmm. What do we say when you come into the program? You need a sponsor. You need a male sponsor. You don't need a female sponsor. And every one of us will almost instinctively pick the opposite sex. Because understand this as general, but it gets to be a manipulative game. Everybody's playing the game. We even know in treatment centers today that don't have same gender tracks, the treatment programs are not as good. There needs to be a female tract as well as a male tract. There'll be times these will be joined together. But I feel this so strongly that I've told treatment centers they'll not get any of our physicians if they don't have gender-specific tracks. If they don't have gender-specific tracks. Because the minute that female is brought into the room with a male, the game starts. Anytime the male is brought in with the female, the game starts. Even later in recovery, hopefully, praise God, we will deal with those. because we're consciously aware of them. Usually after going through the whole process of harms to others and sex conduct and realized how many games we really did play. One of the gals that works for me, who's one of my best friends and was my wife's sponsor for 10 years, we've known Liz since she came in the program. It's been sober 25 years. And she has a statement that she makes to the girls that she sponsors. She says, when my self-esteem and my self-image moved above my waist, I was able to begin my journey to God. That's pretty powerful. When it moved above my waist. Because the manipulation is there. And this is extremely critical. And we are geared as best as anybody.
You're experiencing a lab rat. You know?
What the hell?
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah. God can, he's mimicking me now, isn't he? Yeah, I know he is. So it's obviously break time. Let's take. It's 15 after 4. Let's come back, if you would, at 4:30, and then we'll go ahead with the rest of what we're going to look at in the genetics and the biochemistry and the treatment. All right. All right, when y'all don't get to supper tonight, it's not my fault. It's his fault. What I wanted to do, and I appreciate, again, the opportunity, is I wanted to take a look at I almost forgot it because just explaining these things. But it's the situation, the mind field of medication. And to not address this is to leave a whole big section out that must be dealt with. It just has to be dealt with. I will tell you, I'm absolutely certain today, I'm not telling you that I believe he should have been, I'm just telling you that I'm absolutely certain today if Bill Wilson lived now, he would be on Depakote and Prozac. Now, the question is, should he have been on them? And that severe depression to the point that he would be in bed for 1, 2, and 3 weeks at a time. He even describes many of those depressions, and they're very, very impressive to see the amount of depression that he had. And the communication that he had with Ed Dowling, and I'm sure many of y'all know, or most of you probably know, Ed Dowling was a Jesuit priest from St. Louis who befriended Bill between 1940 and 1960, and then Dowling died in 1960. And they had just an incredible reputation. And I, for one, believe that Dowling was probably the most predominant influence on Bill Wilson during that period of time to keep him tethered at times when he would start. And there were other people who had a great influence on him, and I realize that. But I'm really convinced that Dowling had a lot of influence on Wilson. And if you read their communications, they wrote something like 200-plus letters back and forth in those years. And if you read those letters, and there is a book that you can get, and I can mention it in here because it's not an AA meeting per se. It's called The Soul of Sponsorship, and it's an interesting book to read about their relationship. It's very readable, not that big a book. And when Wilson was high, you could read the letter that he wrote when he was high. When he was down, you could see the difference in his presentation. And when he was down, at least for the last 10 years that he had that relationship with Dowling, he would talk about wanting Dowling to help him convert to Catholicism. And then when Wilson would get high, you could see the tone in the letters, and he would be telling Dowling why he would never convert to Catholicism because he could not believe in the infallibility of the Pope. Now, these are not particularly unique kinds of positions for people to take. But my take-home message is you could watch the swings of this man now. Today, whether he would have been called bipolar or cyclothymic, I don't know. But he really had some real major mood problems. And there's no question that today, he would, if he had gotten caught in some of those particular times when he was really especially depressed, there would have been a decision made to put him on medication. The reason it wasn't done then, there just weren't any medications available that were of any benefit. Even in my years of practicing medicine, up until the advent of the so-called SSRIs, we had very little medicine with the exception of lithium for bipolar disease to treat any kind of mood disorder. We had the tricyclics that we could use, and they really did work as far as sometimes dealing with, at least enough of the times to make them worth using. But usually you couldn't urinate, your mouth was so dry, you couldn't talk. And basically the side effects on those medicines were really pretty significant, just as far as being creating a difficult life. But they would sometimes help with the depression. You know, Elavil comes out of that family of drugs, and we still use it some for peripheral neuritis and neuropathies and things like that. But along came the SSRIs, and they presented us both a wonderful opportunity, and I'm really convinced that God had something to do with these drugs. It also has given us a huge amount of responsibility in determining who gets these, who doesn't get these, what are these drugs really doing, blah, 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 the things that we need to ask. Now, you're not going to have to make those decisions except when you're sponsoring somebody or you hear one of the self-appointed gurus from the podium start trying to practice medicine. And I don't have a problem. They may know more medicine than anybody else. It's just not particularly necessary to talk about it at an AA talk. And I could be wrong, but that's just the boundaries that I put on myself. The SSRIs are good drugs. They are abused and they are prescribed too often. I told you somewhere between 5% and 20% of people would need to be on medication. And that decision would need to be made by somebody who had some significant, extensive experience. Unfortunately, not many doctors do have that kind of experience. So you need to be looking for someone who does. If you don't know the resources in your own community, I would suggest you seek out a doctor in AA in your community and ask that doctor or seek out someone like Scott who's in this community and the people that he would know in this community so that you get a hold of somebody who won't hurt you. I don't think anybody intentionally starts out to hurt anybody, a physician. I just think it happens. I don't think I know it happens. And medications are given out of pure ignorance or just not taking enough responsibility to learn about our disease. Playing both sides of the fence, I get a chance to talk to this group. I get a chance to talk to a group of doctors. And I promise you, I am really, really straightforward and assertive in challenging these doctors to learn about our disease and changing the curriculum in at least the medical schools in Kentucky, which I do have some ability to do, as the doctors try to learn our disease and the best resources within your own AA recovering community, talking to the people that I've talked about, finding out where to go. But these drugs will have to be dealt with. Unfortunately, in many, many treatment centers today, a person is discharged home on a combination of trazodone and Prozac, or trazodone and Paxil, or trazodone and Zoloft. And the trazodone's for sleep and the other is for depression. Well, I told you virtually 100% are going to be depressed. And I really have talked a lot with doctors about this. And many of the doctors who are conscientious will say, we're really frightened because we know the instance of suicide is greater in this population. Somebody goes home, they kill themselves, we are held responsible. And even though we may be able to say we don't believe that that would have made a difference, the plaintiff's attorney doesn't see it that way. And I will promise you that no matter what you hear, and this is not against attorneys, it's against the reality we live in today. Defensive medicine is practiced, and the plaintiff's attorney does appear. And those are things that are dealt with. Fair, unfair, it's the unmanageability of life. Now, what we have to learn is to find the right people to consult with, from our sponsors on down to our family docs, on into the docs that we seek. But I am very grateful to God for giving us some medication today that has minimized to a great extent, or to some extent, the risk we have in taking medicine. The whole group of anticonvulsants, Depakote, Neurontin, Topamax. These are drugs that are given for seizures. And for the first time, we're seeing that some of these drugs will be effective in dealing with the roaring mind that goes on in many of us with the SSRIs. Prozac is still the gold standard, because let me tell you, all the other SSRIs will have a withdrawal effect. If anybody's ever come off of Paxil or Zoloft or Effexor is a drug that'll rip you. I mean, coming off of them, and I'm absolutely convinced from years of experience with these drugs that they are not addicting drugs. I will tell you what they will do and what they're intended to do. Anybody says they don't, hadn't had enough experience with it. They will blunt the ability to have an affect, a mood, to be able to feel pain as much. Now, that's what they're supposed to do. That's why I'm grateful. Don't sit in judgment of God or anybody else. But I'm grateful Bill Wilson came along when they weren't available, because his pain is what brought us home. My pain is what brought me home. But I'm not telling you that you don't need to take medicine. I am telling you, you need to consult with people who really know our disease and know those medicines. And know those medicines. Prozac is the gold standard because its metabolites half-life is so long, it'll basically detox itself. But people coming off of Paxil and Zoloft and some of those others, I will promise you there will be a real feeling of dissociation, muscle spasms, of irritability, and people will relapse in that period of time, or the relapse rate seems to be higher during that time of even changing the medication. All these drugs are coming along. They are better than we've ever had. They still have to be used judiciously. I wouldn't take any drugs for 26 years. Because every drug I ever took just kicked my butt. And I had every reason to be afraid of them, because I had found that I couldn't tolerate tap water if it wasn't the right temperature. I mean, honest to God, that's the truth. And my sponsor and my wife and an addiction psychiatrist that's a good friend of mine that he talks me out, they had sat down, and my support system had sat down and made an intervention on me more than once to take medicine. Can't do it. I worked the program. Praise God, that's what I did, because I got closer to God than I ever would have gotten otherwise. And I'm not saying those medicines will keep people from it, but they do exactly what they're intended to do. And don't forget this, and it may be necessary for it to do it. And don't walk out here and say I'm criticizing or you shouldn't take it. They will blunt the reaction feelings. They will blunt them. And please hear me again. That's not a judgment that they're bad. It's a statement of fact. That's what they're intended to do. But with all those people telling me to take drugs, I mean, there's no question. I've dealt with chronic depression. My gene pool for depression is as wide as my gene pool for alcoholism, and that goes a hell of a long way back. I mean, it was a setup for me to be a drunk and to be depressed from the day I was born. It was just going to happen. That's the way it was. It was just going to happen. And between my own fear and my commitment to this program, I did exactly, and as I look back on it, I did exactly what God wanted me to do. I grew through severe pain, didn't kill myself. And finally, I made the decision after this last episode where I almost died to take some medication. And everybody says I'm better. I don't feel any different. I mean, I don't feel any different, but everybody says I'm better. And what I'm doing is, and I don't mind telling you, because this is the way it is, I take 1 5-milligram Prozac. That's not supposed to knock a dog's ass down, but I mean, it does me. I mean, it apparently it makes me better. And everybody now, I don't think I've moved away from God. I don't think I've moved away from being of maximum service to my fellow man and to God. But I also know I did the right thing for 26 or 27 years. And this is a real, real difficult minefield to walk through, both inside the program and inside medicine. For instance, you look at ADD and ADHD. The drug of choice for that are stimulants. Ritalin, Provigil, amphetamine, dexedrine. Well, I'll show you in a minute why that our cross-sensitivity makes us vulnerable, as my own experience says, to any of these drugs that change our mood, because they all end up working in the same spot. They don't get there the same way. But they end up working the same way in the same spot. Alcohol is a two-point grip shot, and cocaine's a slam-dunk grip shot. They both count 2 points. One makes a hell of a lot of noise, and the other one's subtle. And we're told that. But it's the same deal. You know, I'm not saying that AA should let drug addicts in or drug addicts should let alcoholics in. That's not where I'm going. I'm talking about the physiology and the pharmacology of these drugs. I mean, of all the thousands of people I've seen with ADD and ADHD and been consulted with, I've only had two people that I finally ended up okaying that they be on dextrine. That was not their drug of choice, but I allowed them to do it. It's given with impunity today. Hopefully some of our new drugs like Strattera and some of these drugs are going to help us and not run a risk. But anytime an alcoholic takes a speed drug, there's a high risk of major problems. Now, at the same time, that Elizabeth that I told you about, probably she was a real bad female alcoholic. Her history is incredible. About 10 years ago, she had to have her colon taken out because of ulcerative colitis. She ended up with a short gut syndrome where the bowel was just in constant spasm. She never was a narcotic addict, but they found the only drug that worked, and they went through them all, was Lortab. And she's taken 4 Lortab a day, one before each meal, for 10 years. She's never increased her dose. She's never done a maladaptive way of getting them or taking them. She's physiologically dependent on that drug, but she's not addicted to it, because addiction means maladaptive procuring and use. Those are the definitions today. They've changed, and we changed them. That and the treatment of chronic pain. So she's taking a drug that if she tried to get off of it, she'd have major withdrawals. But she's not addicted because she's never increased the dose, and she ain't stole them, and she hadn't written prescriptions, and she ain't bought them off the street. Do you see the difference? And she doesn't sit in an AA meeting and tell everybody she's taking narcotics. She tells her sponsor. She talks to the right people. And I would defy anybody to tell her that she shouldn't take narcotics. She's at an increased risk. And your take-home message from listening to this presentation is all of us who are alcoholic have a major increased risk in taking any drug of reward. We are. Now, should you take pain medicine? A young woman just came up to me, has had some sort of major surgery, is hurting and won't take pain medicine. Well, I don't know about y'all, but I've attended, I don't know how many meetings over the years. I mean, I've quit counting them where we sit in there and somebody, I'm going into the hospital tomorrow, they're going to give me medicine. What's your experience, strength, and hope? And we share it with each other. I knew when I went in the hospital, I was going to get physiologically dependent on the medicine they gave me. But I hope nobody is stupid enough to come up to me and say, when I'm in that position, you shouldn't take pain medicine, because I'd probably kill them. I mean, I'd probably kill them. But boy, I had that safety net complete, because I knew what was happening. Everybody that even knew my name that's a major player in my life, and there are about 6 of them. I mean a major player. They are the major players. I would tell any of y'all anything you want to know about me just about if it didn't hurt somebody else. But these are the major players in my life. And they all knew what was going to happen with me. You're damn right I took the pain medicine. But I knew I wasn't going to come back and be the same way everybody else would be. So the deal is we take what we need based on what is the right kind of advice and our support system involved so that they can be a part of that decision-making process. This is a very controversial topic in AA, and it's based on our fear, and we're justified in having those fears because so many of us have been hurt. The big book talks about we haven't been honest with the medical profession. Well, that was written in 1938. Small medical profession, small number of people in AA. Today we got 3 million people in AA and a hell of a medical profession, and it is not the same playing field it was in 1938 as far as being intimate and confidential. We got ignorant people dealing with people who are terribly afraid and have every reason to be afraid. And just make sure that you got your troops mobilized. If you don't have a sponsor that you can sleep with and sit in his or her lap, then you better damn well get one. For more reasons than just pain medication.